Hi, I'm Michael, the web guy for KPFA. I just wanted to take a moment to speak to you before this podcast about, money. As you know, KPFA provides downloads of podcasts at no cost to you. We're happy to do so. That's not to say that there's no cost in producing web content. There is, about $30,000 a year. But KPFA tries to provide to our community of listeners the best in alternative programming without a price. But being a community radio station, we look to our listeners from time to time for financial support, usually through on-air fund drives. This is the first time we are coming to you, our podcast listeners, for support. We're not asking for much. We figure if each podcast listener donated $1, just $1 for a year, would be a great way to support programming which is informative, entertaining, and relevant. It's less than 2 cents a week. Come on, isn't this podcast worth 2 cents a week to you? If so, visit our website, kpfa.org, to donate. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to donate more, hey, we won't say no. There are even special gifts available from our recent on-air fund drive. Well, that's my 2 cents worth. How about you? Visit our website, kpfa.org, to support this and other podcasts. I'm Michael the Web Guy. Thanks for listening.
Support. We can bring attention to the struggle for freedom in Burma. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So it's time to go to the big picture and tease it into pragmatic implications as we continue inauguration augury. We know in our etymological bones that the word inauguration does come from augur. The augur was the diviner who walked out into nature, understanding that we live in a storytelling universe, that everything's speaking to us by its shape, its pattern, its color, its design. And the story is that nature would converse with the augur who the most responsible human steward was, and then they would be inaugurated. And we go, oh, may it be so. Let's bring that back. So we're in the Pisces season. Again, the idea of a whole big, pulsing, interrelated dream. As trickster David Grimes says, you know, we signed up for this game because we love this dream. So yesterday was Rudolf Steiner and Ralph Nader's birthday, and we go, oh, happy birthday. And in this season, you know, Pisces in the astrological language, it's the idea of the keeper, again, of the whole large story. Albert Einstein's birthday, Edgar Cayce a few days afterwards with Manly Hall, with great explorer Sir Richard Burton, with Dr. Seuss, and we go, oh, okay. We know that part of our assignment is the wedding of that which has been illusorily estranged. As physics weds metaphysics, they invite and create a child which would be reverent silent science. I go, oh, may it be so. When I was participating with scientists and engineers at a blue salon dedicated to, you know, all the knowledge we know about the dire trouble of water, there was a great moment in which there was a man with a wonderful machine that ran mostly on water and just one tablespoon of gasoline, but it wasn't working. And one of the physicists walked up and said, I think it needs more pressure, and leaned on it. And sensing the moment, with no presumption, I stepped up and said, I think it needs one more thing, possibly magic. And I said to the inventor, do you vow that this technology will never be used for war? And he said, I do. And the machine went va-va-va-vum and sprang to life. And the scientists and engineers were so relieved to be liberated that there's mystery in their lives, going, ha! And that night at the dinner for the scientists and engineers, they all became mystics. They go, you know, physicists really are mystics, and we just need it presented intelligently. So, more than perfectly, our guest today is engaged in that work. Dean Radin, PhD, laboratory director at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, worked at Bell Lab on telecommunications. 2 decades, well, really more, study of psychic phenomena in academia, that we may frolic in the big picture of interrelatedness and tease forth its implications into pragmatic mysticism. His most recent book is Entangled Minds, and his website is deanradin.com. So welcome, Dean.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So there's so many wonderful places to go. But Entangled, we were talking backstage, and I said, the Entangled Minds. I said, I wish there was a better word or another word. And you said, it's the original German?
The original German word, when translated, actually means intertwined, with the image of arms crossed across the chest. So it's a entanglement, but of an orderly sort, not the kind of chaotic entanglement that you might have with the image of like a ball of yarn on the floor.
Right, because entangled, if you said, you were entangled with somebody, people would say, well, how do we help you out of that? But this, of course, is, a description of, everything related, everything pulsing in one vast kind of interwoven relationship. And there's a great, your PR ally guided me to something that's posted at sfgate.com right now, an interview with you, which also mentions that you've co-founded the Boundary Institute, and since 2001 you've been the senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And you recently gave a talk at Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And How did that go?
I thought it was great fun.
Yeah.
Normally when I give talks to both technical audiences and to popular audiences, they're both fun for different reasons. The popular audiences is a little bit like preaching to the converted, and so I have to put on a more skeptical stance, or at least I feel that that's part of my role, is to educate people about what you can and cannot believe, or at least what is believable and less believable. Whereas in a scientific audience, part of my role is to not only maintain a skeptical position, because most of them come from that anyway, but to help loosen them up and to illustrate that there is an enormous amount of empirical data, whether they're aware of it or not, and some of the things that they thought might be true may in fact not be true at all.
Yes, you do a fine job of that. I love in the interview that when the interviewer said, were you trying to suggest that Google employees shouldn't view, psi things as taboo? And you said you really don't try to convince anyone of anything. You want people to make up their own minds.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think the role of an educator is to provide information in as neutral a way as you possibly can. But I don't like being proselytized, and so I don't like to do that to anybody else either.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, we'd say certainly as one of our work themes on the table, what serves tyranny and what serves freedom, democracy in our own cells, and certainly we don't want to strip anybody's autonomy away. And you're certainly diving us into the distinction, a number of important distinctions. One, there's the psychotic distinction, which you maybe can elaborate, and then there's the knowledge versus superstition, which is kind of related. But do you want to speak about to the psychic-psychotic kinship?
Well, just as there's a relationship between creativity, genius, and madness, there's a relationship between people who are psychic without being crazy and people who are psychic and psychotic at the same time. In other words, a psychopathological angle to this. It's undeniable that some people who would be regarded as schizophrenic, for example, probably are having genuine psychic experiences. But what makes them go a little batty is that they can't control it. In fact, of the emails and phone calls I usually get, about half of them are from people who are very disturbed by the experiences that they're having, which sound like a variety of different kinds of psychic phenomena, and they're disturbed by them and they want them to stop. Well, those are people that I immediately send to a psychiatrist, because whether they're delusional or not, I can't tell over the phone, but in a sense it doesn't matter. Even if they're perfectly normal but just having intrusive telepathic connections with somebody else, they need to figure out how to deal with that first. And so that's the pathological side of these phenomena.
And there is, I don't know if you know, the great story of James Joyce and his schizophrenic daughter, who he took to all the great healers of Europe and said, no, she's a genius like me. And they washed up on Jung's doorstep, and he talked to the daughter and came out and said, no, she's really bleeping nuts. The difference is you're diving, she's falling.
Right.
Which is...
They both might actually end up in the same place, but it's... If when you've dived off the cliff and you reach the bottom, if you can't swim, you're in trouble. So I don't think we understand very well yet how to help somebody who is not able to swim in the psychic space. But oftentimes, what people will say, I'd like to learn how to become much more psychic than I already am, and I would ask them, oh, really, you want to do that? Because you're getting. I mean, I think it is possible to learn to become much more sensitive to these things, but it may not be advisable in many cases.
Really? In some cases. Well, I'm not sure. I think part of the important bridge work that you're doing is, you know, to open up this conversation. At one point, I fell into talking to a number of policemen, and they came up and they said, you know, we've had these psychic experiences, but we can't talk to anybody because we'll get sent to the shrink. But there were... a lot of them. They said, I haven't told anybody. And I go, the person next... I mean, they were surrounded by people who had actually genuine precognition or something that spooked them or something that, you know, would fall into your terms of psychic, but they didn't want to talk to anybody else about it. And I realized, in a sense, you know, like a policeman and whatever, we're hiring them societally to be our shamans, to deal with life and death and that borderland where so much can take place. But without this conversation that can help them to understand what's going on. And I mean, do you view that part of your dedication, in a sense, is to open up the conversation, at least, you know, so that it can take place without, you know, it being labeled as aberrant or psychotic or delusional?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, because exactly the same issue occurs in academia. I mean, you would hope that in the centers of knowledge that all ideas would be on a level playing ground and that there wouldn't be taboos that prevent certain things from being talked about. But, of course, that's not true. And one of the taboos, a very strong taboo, prevents scientists from talking to each other about things that they personally find very interesting. In fact, being more public about this than other scientists, I act like a lightning rod sometimes for academics who are secretly interested and need to speak to somebody, so they call me up and I talk to them. And on more than one occasion, I've had somebody call me from the same department of the same university.
Right.
So I would say, well, do you know so-and-so who happens to be down the hall from you? And then they said, well, of course I know them. Well, did you know that they're also interested in this topic? And they had no idea.
Right.
And these are people who may have been working together for 20 years, and it just never came up.
Well, and that's the exact same experience of the cops coming up, were talking, and then their partner of 20 years would come up and say, I've never told anyone. And I go, your partner has the same experience, you know. So really intimate. So we're opening up, you know, again, serves, not serves tyranny, serves, you know, openness. But when you say the cultivation, you know, it's certainly in the tradition of metaphysics, it's the idea that we don't need more powers, but to honor and cultivate those with which we're all endowed. And, you know, so the cultivation of empathy, certainly, the cultivation of a sense of interrelatedness and kinship, mm-hmm. that's clearly desirable. You can't lose there, right?
I think for most people it's desirable. What I'm talking about more for psychic experience is for when it's not so much the cultivation of the experience as what people think they're going to use it for. And that's where it's something like you need not only to learn how to do these kinds of things, but also get a good dose of wisdom about why and where and how to use them. So that what comes to mind for a lot of skeptics, for example, is they'll suddenly get superpowers and they'll be able to go to a casino and make a lot of money. And when I challenge them, I'm saying, oh, is that really what you would do if you suddenly had amazing psychic skills? They can't think of anything else that they want to do.
Right.
So I would say, well, okay, I guess, you know, if that's what you really want to do, that's fine. But there's so many other things that would be useful to do for the world that don't involve such crass needs.
Absolutely. And I guess that's also the tradition, say, in Tibetan Buddhism or in Indian meditation, that people, the teacher would say, pay no mind to these things. They're just distractions. You know, you don't want to translate a kind of celebrity consciousness of, you know, using this in a trivial, superficial way. I love what you said in the SF Gate interview. The interviewer says, do you think that we all have some extrasensory abilities? And you say, I think we do, in the same way that we could all play golf. But we're not all going to win the Masters.
That's right.
Yeah. And is it like golf? You have to practice. Well, you have innumerable expressions in your book of how telepathy, scientific experiments, remote viewing, clairvoyance, and those things can be increased. You know, I just remember a million years ago in a kind of crank mystery school, we were training, and there is a value to training in a group. We would shuffle a deck of cards face down and say, you know, pick the queen of spades, you know, and no, wouldn't get it, then would get it three times in a row, just shuffling and then doing it. And then everybody else in the room would get it too, and you'd have that feeling, and then it would go away again. Mm-hmm. Is that analogous to your experience in more controlled circumstance?
It is, yeah. And it also is true even for sports and learning how to play a musical instrument. Practice definitely helps. A lot of practice will raise you to a new plateau, but you may stay at that plateau for quite a long time. And then it takes sometimes years to advance to each new plateau. And in the beginning, usually progress is the fastest, but at some point people will flatten out, and they basically can't go any further, and that has something to do with natural talent.
Yes, although you know, there was on Way Outdoor, I thought, let me just check my email to see if there's something pertinent to my conversation with Dean Radin, you know, and somebody had forwarded a great YouTube clip called In Service, and it's just a little video of a man going, oh, parking space, you know, taken by somebody else, annoying, you know, waiting for coffee, annoying, and then a man walks up and hands him glasses, and when he puts on the glasses, he can see everyone's story, you know, just lost best friend, just, you know, and that sense of extended, you know, empathic compassion, and we go, yes, you know, there were the studies done also of the Dalai Lama's, you know, master meditators and wired up, and that when they felt compassion for a world, there are certain parts of their brain that just lit up. And I just thought, now that could supplant, you know, presidential debates. Why don't we just wire these guys up, you know, and go, do you really have goodwill for the world? Let's see, you know. But are you familiar with those experiments too, the wiring of the brain and the different parts of the brain that light up when there's compassion or deep meditation that is absolutely a skill?
Yes, yes, and the more research we have on meditation, I think the more we'll see that the brain does change. But I think what also we'll see is that the classic siddhis from yogic lore, and as well the charisms from Catholicism, they're both basically saying the same thing, that at the far ranges of human capacity, there's something peculiar that happens when you begin to train your mind, and you start bumping into all of the things like clairvoyance is one of the very first things that a meditator will bump into. And I think the reason why there's admonitions to not pay too much attention to it is it comes out of spiritual practice, where the goal is not to get stuck in psychic phenomena, but to just see it as a mark along the way. From a scientific perspective, though, we're still struggling from a mainstream perspective to have the ability to publish a paper on telepathy, for example, in a mainstream journal. Now, there are some papers published in top-ranked journals within disciplines, like psychology, but to get into the tip-top range, where you're talking about journals like Science and Nature, it's virtually impossible to publish a study having to do with psychic phenomena, because the editors have the same taboo that all the other scientists feel. So to break that taboo and to allow this to take place, I think it would be very interesting if the current neuroscience studies, which are beginning to look at the very elementary stages of meditation, begin to take on the next stage. Well, the next stage is, as I said, they're going to bump into the siddhis. And wouldn't it be interesting if, through Western scientific methods, it turned out that we're able to verify that some of the cities are true?
Well, you...
And, of course, the whole point of my book, Entangled Minds, is pointing out that we already are there. And in fact, we've been there for probably a half a century.
And also, you have worked in the government's programs on remote viewing, yeah?
Right. So we have good evidence from a completely Western point of view that some of the elementary cities are probably correct. I'm less interested in that question now because I've been working on it a long time, and more interested in the more far-out cities. For example, there's lots of lore about breatharians who apparently live on spiritual energy alone. I'd like to know if that's actually possible. It seems so far away from what we normally think of as nutrition that it seems impossible. But I've learned to be open-minded about these things and to study first and make up my mind later.
Oh, how wonderful. Exactly, because you're such a great bridge. I mean, I used to have a category called hysterical rationalism in which, you know, alleged scientists would get just livid when any of these topics were brought up, and certainly astrology gives people conniption fits, and homeopathy gives many mainstream doctors conniption fits because there is no theory, or it challenges, you know, and that idea of saying, well, let's see, as a friend, Steve Behrman says, sure, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? You know, and how wonderful it is to be open and deal every day with mystery, going, let's see, and then what does this imply? And maybe we have to work backwards to challenge some of our assumptions and have a lot, you know, really, truly freed up thinking. But my interest is you know, so much in your book, but you do get to this point, although at the very end you say, you know, you haven't been teasing the practical implications, but you do allude to them, and maybe it will be your next book. But you quote engineer William Rowe saying, every so often we hear of a group of people who unite under extreme pressure to achieve seemingly miraculous results. In these moments, human beings transcend their personal limitations and realize a collective synergy with results that far surpass expectations based on past performance. Fine symphony, jazz group, you know, perhaps less frequent, you know, sports, you know, talented amateur, you know, all of that. So I'm interested, you know, there are many experiments or informal things, people going, let's all meditate on this day, let's all do this. And you do have a, I mean, you're engaged in that experiment as well, right?
Right. Primarily through the Global Consciousness Project, which
right.
is from Princeton University. That's what I've spent most of my my time on, in looking at collective effects.
So what do you think would be is good, or tell us more about the Global Consciousness Project?
This project is a way of addressing Carl Jung's idea of the collective unconscious, that if there really is something like an effect of intention that's expressed into the world directly, meaning an unmediated intention that affects the world, and if that intention can be boosted by the acts of lots of intentions all happening in alignment at the same time, then presumably there are aspects of the world that should change. So from a conventional point of view, this is like crazy. People don't want it to rain. They all do an anti-rain dance, and sure enough, it doesn't rain, or vice versa. But the approach that we took was based on about 50 years of previous experiments in the laboratory suggesting that there really is a connection between mind and matter, or particularly between attention and intention and the behavior of random systems. The reason these experiments have been done is because when you attend to something, or if you intend, it's a moment you can think of as a moment of mental coherence. It takes what is ordinarily lots of scattered thoughts, perhaps, and momentarily becomes very coherent. And if mind and matter are in some respects the same, in the same way that we now know that matter and energy are the same, it's the same thing in different form. If this is true for mind as well, then when mind becomes very coherent, perhaps matter also becomes very coherent. So you could do an experiment where you have somebody mentally try to intend to get inside an orange, say, but it would be very difficult to measure how does the orange change or how would a rock change. These things are so stable that it's very difficult to measure change. So instead we use something which is physical matter, except it's extremely easy to change, and it turns out that one of the easiest things is the equivalent of flipping coins. Because when a coin flips onto heads or tails, the amount of energy it takes to do that when it comes down to the final decision is basically a quantum decision. It's extremely small amounts of energy that ultimately end up in a heads or tail. So we don't use coins. We use electronic circuits where the source of the randomness in the circuit is quantum events. So we have people aim their intention at these circuits and try to create more zeros or more ones effectively. And 50 years of experiments suggest that people can do that. So what Roger Nelson, who is the prime mover on the Global Consciousness Project, one day Roger and I and a few others were talking about the studies he had started to do called field consciousness studies, where you have a group like a group of meditators, and you simply put a random number generator in the vicinity of the group of meditators, and you measure what's happening in the random generator. And as it turns out, that in a group of people who are being mentally very coherent, the randomness becomes more orderly, more so than you'd expect by chance. And when the group goes away and the device is allowed to run all by itself, it goes back to behaving randomly. So from this we can infer that there's something about the nature of group coherence that physically changes at least the local vicinity in a way that we can measure.
Well, yeah, and this is, you know, extremely intriguing. You mentioned at the end of the book, you know, the Princess Diana's funeral and how that registered. Can you elaborate on that and that with random number generators, yeah?
Sure. When the Princess Diana funeral was a good example of a planned event where we were able to anticipate perhaps a billion people, a large proportion of the Earth's population, all paying attention to the same thing at the same time. Because the funeral was broadcast live around the world, and a lot of people were going to watch it. So since we had done studies with small meditating groups, we figured, well, maybe this effect works at the level of the entire world. And here we have now, it's not a meditation, but a lot of people thinking about the same thing at the same time because they're all watching it live or listening to it live. So we got together with a dozen colleagues. Each of us had an electronic random number generator, and we all agreed in advance to run it during the course of the funeral, actually before, during, and after, and then we would see whether the compound evidence from all of our 12 generators was in alignment with chance or not. And as it turned out, that before the funeral and after the funeral, they were behaving quite nicely by chance, but during the funeral, it wasn't. And it was as a result of that experiment, which suggested something like a global effect, that we started this thing called the Global Consciousness Project. So in August, it'll be 10 years old, and it has involved in the very beginning three random number generators, and now about 60, all running 24/7, and all of the data being sent upstream to a single server at Princeton, where we analyze the data. So from August of 98 until today, we've looked at 245 large-scale events that happened in the world, which each event designed and selected by us to be able to infer that some large percentage of the world had paid attention to that event.
Yeah, because then you also mentioned 9/11 as one of those, you know, Princess Diana's funeral, 9/11. And then also, I don't know if you mentioned this too, but the anniversary of 9/11 in 2002, the three-number New York lottery was 9/11. So
that's right.
They have everybody concentrating on that. Well, now we tease it into what about many people concentrating on, say, an election? So you're going to be running it that way, and I did want to, you know, backstage I said, you know, what about voting machines? Could people, you know, have an intention that no matter how they were programmed, that they be honest and reflective? You know, a friend of mine said she's worried about Ohio, which hasn't had an honest election in 8 years. So is that a worthy experiment? You know, that people would go, no matter how you're programmed, may you reflect the truth.
Well, sure, because even if it's not something spooky and psychic, just the fact of having a large number of people paying attention,
yes,
to anything,
right,
of this sort that's important is a very important thing to do. So sometimes I'm asked, well, if everybody prayed for peace, would that cause peace? And my answer is, you bet it will, because if everybody's praying for peace, there's no one left to push the buttons or hold the guns. The question is, what happens if almost everyone is praying for peace, but there are a couple of people out there who would rather not? Well, then it starts to become more tricky. My guess is that large numbers of people being in alignment about the same thoughts does carry an enormous power from a completely ordinary secular point of view, and maybe the results of the experiments that we're looking at, maybe even on another level as well.
Yeah, I mean, experiment. I like to say that, you know, there's no two sides, only those who are, you know, dynamically dedicated to peace and those who are not yet. And for those who are not yet, perhaps we might want to give them some intentional chocolate. And maybe you could explain what intentional chocolate is, as you did to the Google guys.
Well, this came about from a thought experiment, or actually a common experience I think many people have. Which is, what does mom's chicken soup taste better and feel better than the same ingredients taken out of a can? Could it be that, in this case, the intention behind the cooking, could love actually be an ingredient? Or is it something that you can feel? So these are the sorts of discussions I have with people all the time about common experiences that we take more or less as folklore or superstitions, and yet they are testable. One of the nice things about science, if you're clever enough, you can figure out how to test almost anything. We decided to go ahead and test the idea that that good intentions would affect how people responded when they ate food, and the food in this case was chocolate. So the experiment worked by having samples of chocolate, some of which were treated by the strong, focused intentions of Tibetan Buddhist monks and a Mongolian shaman, who were told to impress into the chocolate that anybody who ate that chocolate would feel less fatigue, greater vigor, and an improved mood. Now, we asked for that particular intention because chocolate normally will elevate the mood a little bit, but it's usually a short-acting effect. It's like 20 minutes after you have some chocolate, you feel a little bit better, but the effect begins to go away pretty quickly. Well, what we wanted was an effect that would be strong enough so that when people are asked at the end of the day to record their mood over the course of the day, that there would be an effect. And we also asked people to eat the chocolate over the course of a week, to eat it on the three middle days of the week with the hope that there might be something like a cumulative effect, eating the same chocolate 3 days in a row. And so what we found was that the mood, and by the way, we measured mood using a standard questionnaire called the Profile of Mood States, which is used in lots of medical studies. We used that. That was our main measure. What we found was that the people eating the intentional chocolate under placebo-controlled double-blind conditions reported a significantly better mood as compared to the people who were eating the chocolate that wasn't intentionally imprinted.
That's great. We're going to take a very short break right now and come back on chocolate. Our guest today is Dean Radin, and you can join us if you are inadvertently patient after break by calling 510-848-4425, and we'll be right back.
Shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his thomas cry. indigo skyship make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, Allies to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest today is Dean Radin. His latest book is Entangled Minds, Extrasensory Experiences in a Quantum Reality. His website is deanradin.com. And just one way in which the sun introduced you, Dean, actually was that there are images for each degree of the zodiac. So today, when we began the show, the image for the sun was aviator sails across the sky, master of the high realms, gaining a perspective which transcends current systems of analysis, formulating and testing new operative hypotheses, confident navigation in the mental spiritual realms, and starting processes on a mental spiritual level which will eventually manifest in a better life for future generations. So that's how, you know, the planetary patterns describe you.
Right. That's very nice.
Yeah, there you go.
So my birthday is tomorrow.
Oh, and so you are a Pisces like Einstein and all these fun teammates.
I'm not just a Pisces, but a leap Pisces.
Ah, yes, you are. That's really fabulous. And it is, you know, that your book provides, you know, much useful survey grist. You talk about many people, you know, our allies in the past. You speak about Upton Sinclair, you know, who wrote The Jungle in 1906, you know, about horrible meatpacking practices. And then he wrote a book called Mental Radio with his wife, Mary Craig Sinclair, proving telepathy. And he invited Einstein to write the preface, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
And Einstein, of course, is a fellow Pisces teammate of yours. That's wonderful that you are that. And very perfect too. Yeah, there's the conversation, you know, again, yes, not wanting to convince anybody, that's really great, but to expand and believe nothing but entertain possibilities. You know, certainly astrology is, you know, people go, oh, that's, yeah, yeah. And there are cute quips that astrologers have come up with going, there's absolutely no astrological evidence that science is anything but a primitive medieval superstition, just as a kind of rejoinder. But this to-ing and fro-ing, and I think when we took break, I was cutting you off in your, wrap-up of the, intentional chocolate experiment, but you were basically saying that food that had been blessed in a double-blind experiment, the results significantly supported the idea of people reporting having better mood, and so it really had an effect in your mind, even under a scientific examination. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very surprised. I had not done an experiment like this before, and I'm not aware of anyone else who had. I kind of suspected it might work because of many experiments like this before.
Yes, you don't have to pay attention to the spirit voices, Dean. Those are for me. But that's what was the very last thing that you just said?
Well, I was surprised that it worked, but I mean, I was pleased that it worked, but I really was kind of surprised because this is not simply a matter of intention focusing on some kind of measuring device. It was one step away from that. It's like close encounters of the third kind in the sense that it's one person's intention onto a substance, another person eating the substance, and having their behavior change as a result. Well, that's already several links away from the original intention, and yet it seems to work. So, it's quite interesting, and among other things, people have asked, well, does that mean if I go to McDonald's, and everyone is all loving and singing.
Yes.
Cooking.
Well, there's
is that going to make it better? And I would have to say yes. I guess it would make it better.
And that would be a miracle as well. Yes.
Well, by the same token, if you go to a fancy restaurant and everybody inside is crying or angry, I don't think I want to eat there.
No, that's really true. I mean, again, it's the examining of things that are either so close to us that they become invisible, like people saying grace, and you know, and then also the whole realm of, you know, prayer, practice, blessings, you know, good night prayers with children. We go, yeah, you know, and then certainly the power of myth and fairy tales as kind of guides through this, in which you say you remind us at the beginning of your book that it all relates to, you know, what we call supernatural qualities bestowed on the hero from somewhere in a time of need. And we go, yes, these things. But I like the I like the experiment, and I like being able to, yeah, to talk to grown-up scientists with armed with your material, going, did you know that intentional chocolate has been proven by double-blind studies that, yes, praying over food is actually good for you, and maybe transforms the molecules, although you're not going that far. We don't know.
Yeah, we haven't looked at the biochemical structure yet, but we do plan on future experiments to do that.
And then, you know, another a pop scientist out there, Dr. Masaru Emoto, with his, I don't know if you, do you call them experiments with water? Are you familiar with that body of work that's been presented?
I am. I did an experiment with Dr. Emoto.
Oh, what?
Like many people, I've seen him give a talk, and it's a very beautiful talk about with pictures of nice-looking crystals and not-so-nice-looking crystals. And every scientist is thinking exactly the same thing I'm thinking of, which is how many pictures were taken
right.
of these crystals. And so are we seeing just the 10 that ended up looking nice and there's a million that we're not looking at? So we don't know in the way that he presents the results. So after one of these talks, I went up to him and said, would you be interested in doing a double-blind experiment so we can get away from expectation bias and selection and all those other things? And to my delight, he said yes.
Mm.
He'd be happy to do that. So a couple of years ago, I did do an experiment with him where he had 2,000 people in Tokyo sending their beautiful thoughts to our lab here up at the Institute of Noetic Sciences to two bottles of water that were in our fancy shielded room here. And he knew in advance that I would then send these two bottles back to him, and he would go through his crystallization process and so on and see what he gets. But what I didn't tell him at the time was I had two additional bottles, which I had set aside, that would act as controls. And so I sent him four bottles, and I didn't tell him which bottle was which. So he would be blind to which bottle was which. And now the question is, what were the since the whole claim has to do with the aesthetic beauty of crystals, then that would be our measurement. People then would look at the crystals and make a judgment of the aesthetic beauty of the different crystals coming out of the different sources of water.
And let me just add for our listeners what Dr. Masaru Emoto's premise was. He would take water, freeze it, and then photograph it under a high-powered electromagnetoscope. And the presentation that both Dean Radin and I have been to that he gives is he says, here's spring water, and you look at the crystals. Oh, how beautiful. Here's polluted water. Ugh. Here's water that's been prayed over. Oh, it's beautiful again. All right, now back to you, Dean.
Right. So that's a pretty remarkable claim. And the way it's presented, it looks simple. Looks like it, you know, it's, how could anybody deny that such a thing is true?
Well, we want it to be true.
Yeah, we want it to be true. We'd like to take polluted water and pray over it, and suddenly it becomes miraculous. So, of course, the reason for doing this under double-blind conditions is it gets rid of the natural tendency to pick the good stuff and to leave the rest of it behind. In this case, the person who took the pictures of the crystals didn't have any idea what the water source was from. So I then put on the web pictures of all of the crystals that had been taken, all the photographs, and I asked people blindly to just go to the website and to make an assessment as to how beautiful each one of these pictures were. And of course, since they didn't know where the pictures came from or the conditions, then you get an unbiased assessment. And I had, I forget how many, 500 or so people all come in on the website. And so we got a very good measure of the degree of aesthetic beauty of each crystal. And then the final analysis says, well, we ended up with this many crystals from the treated water and this many from the control. What is the overall average in terms of the degree of aesthetic beauty? And is it in the direction that Dr. Emoto claims? And the answer is yes.
Oh, I'm so relieved. Oh, that's wonderful.
The magnitude of the effect is really, really small.
Okay.
you need statistics in order to be able to show that there's a real difference.
Uh-huh.
But the statistical difference was a probability of less than 0.01. So it's not a whoppingly significant effect, but it was significant, and we predicted that ought to be the effect if the claim is true.
Right.
That's been published.
Uh-huh.
And we've since done a triple-blind version of this study, which I haven't published it yet, but that also was successful. So it does suggest that when Dr. Emoto, the way he presents the results is not as a scientist.
No.
When I present the results, I show all of the data, and then you can see that there is a real effect, except that the results are not as strong as they seem to be when he talks about it.
Right. No, that's great, and that's a great to and fro. Let's go to our first really patient caller, Marion Vacaville. Come in.
Yes, hello. Well, the intentional chocolate really helped to explain something I've always been saying here at home when someone in the family would bring me a glass of water. Now, what could be more simple than a glass of water? It's from the same source, you know, and it's always, it's not a different water, just our household water. They bring me a glass of water, and I used to joke, they think it was funny. I said, oh, it always tastes better when you give it to me. But I really meant it. I said, why does it taste better when you give it to me? Rather than I just go and get it for myself. And I've been,
right.
And I honestly feel that, you know, but they thought I'm just maybe being, you know, trying to say something nice or so, but I really felt it. So you helped me to explain that. I'm going to tell them about that. And the other comment, if I may bring one more, at the beginning of your interview, I'll have to check your book to see more what you're talking about. But when I was in college, there was a nun giving some kind of practice of how to train the mind to do some healing. And we would put ourselves kind of into self-hypnosis, but we'd have like a screen in front of our eyes. And then we'd use that screen to put people into it, visualize people, and then we'd test it on other classmates, and they'd just give us the name of a person, and you scan the screen up and down until you start to visualize a person, and you start to describe them. And I was not really believing this was possible, but it happened. I would start to describe them, but not just their outer features like the color of the hair and whether it was curly or straight, but start to explain like their wrist, you know, was like aching and there was a pain in their left, like the kidney area. And they'd say, yes, yes. And I didn't know what to do with it. I was quite young. I thought, oh, I don't know what I want to do with it. It's for healing, but how do I do that? Where am I going with this? And then some friends of mine tried to practice with me on a friend of theirs, and I had a very bad experience because this friend was really messed up, and I jumped up. I said, who is that? And they said, well, actually, this person they gave me the name of had tried to suicide, had taken some drugs, and I thought, uh-oh, I don't think I want to be this sensitive. And so I understood completely when you said, do we really want these powers? I had a friend with sick children who wanted to develop it so she could help heal her children if possible. I said, well, I understand your need, but I'll just tell you what happened to me. And, you know, it is something you have to be careful with. We are given limits for a reason, I think. I think we all have it in us, but we're given shields for our own benefit sometimes.
That's great, Mary. Thank you for your call,
and
let's let Dean respond. And that kind of guides us also to the work of our colleague Larry Dossey, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is true that we're all connected whether we know it or not. These abilities are not magically bestowed on us. There's something that's already there, and we become aware of it. And so the reason why I think the caller's experience is a good lesson in that once you actually become aware of how connected you are to other people, maybe sometimes it's too much information. You don't always want to know that because it has a certain responsibility that comes along with it as well.
Well, it's like, you know, again, when I'm working with charts, you know, I say the people who have Pisces planets, like yourself, Dean, I go that there is, you know, if we lived in a wise traditional culture, you would have been, you know, honored, recognized, and trained as an empath. And what we've kind of lost, and what I think you're kind of recovering, it's a very interesting historic process, is that idea of training, boundaries, you know, so that one can connect empathically, but then filter and discriminate between, you know, true insight and making things up, but also being overwhelmed It's why just in the kind of popular 50-cent astrology, Pisces are thought of as theoretical physicists and kind of way out there, but also, you know, incredibly intricate theory as a kind of rope bridge across a chasm of wonder going, whoa. So it can also be the most theoretically complex of all the people who are assigned to that, you know, that particular sun sign. But, yes, those are good points. But, you know, so when did you meet Larry Dossey? Because his work in, when he was head of, I think, San Francisco General, was people being prayed over in intensive care who didn't know they were being prayed over. And what he kind of elicits from that is that two crucial principles, non-specificity was more effective. It was better to send general goodwill to someone than to pray for their gallbladder, you know, and then also non-locality. It didn't matter where you were. And is Larry an ally, colleague, buddy of yours?
Oh, yeah, for many years. I just saw him this past weekend down just south of San Francisco at a book launch. We had both written chapters for a book.
And I think this is also where you can both bring things to bear. I mean, there's a complex etiquette, certainly in a conversation around, you know, people who are ill and the idea of the mind-body connection. And, you know, conversation recently, somebody said, what do you think about that? You know, she had a friend who had cancer. And I go, it's a complex issue. You know, Larry Dossey, many things, nothing simple. And she goes, well, we think it's all baloney because, you know, how dare you accuse somebody of creating their own illness? And I go, it's more complex. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
So how do you contribute to that conversation? We sort of, it's not simple, you know.
Well, this was asked by the person who did the interview for the Chronicle, and it has to do with New Age guilt.
Right.
That if you strongly believe that every whim that you have comes true, and you end up being sick, or worse, someone you didn't like ends up being sick, then you're going to harbor a certain amount of guilt that you're not thinking right. Well, some of that's probably true, but a lot of it's probably not true. As what we see in these experiments on the psychic ability is most of the time they're quite weak. The effects are real, but they're weak.
Mm.
It's difficult sometimes for people who are not used to statistics to wrap their mind around the idea that something can be a very weak effect, and yet it is also very real. So to help them, I would say, well, why do you suppose that Bayer aspirin is able to sell with FDA approval to take a little aspirin every day to prevent a second heart attack or to prevent stroke? Well, it's because they know it's a real effect. But when you look at the magnitude, how big that effect is, what proportion of the time it actually works, it's a really tiny effect. And the only reason we know it's true is because there have been studies done with tens of thousands of people that show that on average, over long periods of time, yes, aspirin will help a little bit. But it doesn't help a lot. And that same is true then for these kinds of phenomena, that the remote viewing is real. Precognition is real, so are mind-matter interaction effects. But if you sit down in front of a radioactive source and damage enough chromosomes, it probably doesn't matter what your intention is. You're going to probably end up being pretty ill anyway.
Yes, no, that's an important fine distinction to put on our table. I do remember reading an article in the Washington Post on remote viewing in 1980, projects the government was doing, and they actually scrapped hiding the plan of hidden silos. You know, some silos were loaded with hot and nuclear weapons and some not, because in Russia and America, the psychics accurately predicted sufficiently to scrap that program, going, oh, to hell with that thing.
That's right. And that actually is a good example, because in a case of shuttling missiles around randomly, the only value of it is that the enemy doesn't know where to target your missiles. And so it's the randomness that makes it a difficult problem. But if you're able to outguess the randomness just a smidgen, even a tiny little bit, then you gain an advantage. And it was demonstrated, I know on our side, I'm not sure about the Russians, but that the psychics could outguess where the supposed random missiles were, and that didn't make them very useful anymore.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Russians were way ahead of it. I mean, the ancient book in the 70s, you know, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, Lynn Schroeder and Sheila Ostrander was a book that many of us read a million years ago. But Yeah, the Russians, you know, studying psychic stuff, but in a kind of up to no good way, you know, I mean, like, how can we use this to influence people? And then I guess the American thing, part of the American program was, say, astronauts lost mechanical, you know, contact, communication contact, could telepathy be part of that program? And is that something that you were a part of as well?
I was. But actually, you know, the idea, it's kind of a popular myth now that the Russians were way ahead of us.
Oh, really?
In recent years, and I'm not going to tell the whole story here because it's a long story and it's actually somebody else should tell it. But I know that there's been a detente, just as there have been a political detente, there was on the side of people doing psychic research as well for our government and for the Russian government, or at the time the Soviet Union. So we both had programs. And we both probably thought that each other was ahead, and in fact probably used that to some extent in the same way that the space race was useful politically because it helped raise a lot of money and interest. So since the detente occurred and our people met their people, they met their counterparts, we have a much better idea now about what they were actually doing and what they actually knew as compared to what we actually were doing and we actually knew. And to make a long story short, neither of us really knew a whole lot. We were both doing interesting things in slightly different directions, but there are no amazing secrets that aren't available out there in one book or another, except maybe the inside story of this detente that took place. And that book will probably come out in a year or two, and that's about as much as I can say about it.
Okay, that's good. Let's slip in another patient caller, Matthew in San Francisco. Come in if you're still
here. Yes, hi, Carolyn. Thank you so much for another great show. I'd like to raise, I think, one of the larger issues that come out of this sort of larger complex of science and religion or science and metaphysics. And my question is, what will it take for science to play fair? If parapsychology has thousands of good studies, if the anthropological record shows that there's this interesting anecdotal evidence that goes back thousands of years, if the new neuroscientific research shows that what prior science or 20th century science totally dismissed actually has physical reality in the brain, if quantum physics and the new theories coming out of cosmology completely change our views or completely undermine all the mechanistic views of mind and body, what will it take for a larger shift in science so that they play fair, play by their own rules and say, yes, there's something real here and it speaks to the biggest issues of human existence?
Fabulous. Fabulous question, and Dean is uniquely equipped, I think, to answer that. Here you go, Dean.
Well, we're dealing with a prejudice, and just like racial and gender prejudice, it's exceptionally difficult to overcome. You can't do it very quickly. I think the answer to your question is that, fortunately, science is not a dogmatic body of knowledge. It has a lot of inertia in the theories that describe the way the world works, and that inertia is essentially the mainstream scientific worldview. But it does change. It changed the worldview a century ago, and the worldview now is radically different, and it'll be radically different again a century from now. And the reason I'm optimistic is that when you look at the evolution of the worldviews that are painted by science, it's getting closer and closer and closer, and certainly pointing in the direction where at some day in the future, the worldview will become so compatible with the idea of something like non-local mind that they will look back historically at the thousands of experiments that we have, and they'll say, well, you know, that makes sense. And it'll be very much like when they were looking back when Wegener was proposing the idea of continental drift, and he had a huge amount of empirical evidence, but it was laughed at, because at the time people thought that the continents couldn't move. Well, now we look back and we see that the evidence is obvious. It's obvious that the continents move because that's what the geological record says. It's easy. So something like that is going to happen in our future, and the reason it's taken hundreds and hundreds of years to get there is probably because the power of the mechanistic approach and the material mechanistic approach that science has taken is so seductive and so demonstrably powerful and useful. I mean, my ability to talk over my computer at the moment for this broadcast is evidence of the high reliability and usefulness of the mechanistic approach that science has been built upon. But this very same approach eventually has moved it further and further away from its origins back in Newton's day. And the change, the shifting in worldview is not yet caught up to most people. I mean, most scientists don't think very much, if they think at all, about the way that the basic underpinnings of our worldview has changed from Newton's day until today. That's partially because most scientists are not given courses in the history of science or the philosophy of science, and so they don't have any reason to think about it. But the world today is extremely different than the world that Newton lived in, and yet our common sense is still very much Newtonian.
And we are all too soon with it, but we, hooray for empathic kinship even being proved by the likes of yourself. And voting machines, I think we should all just intend the voting machines are honest as well. And Philip Dick says, Valis, vast, active, living, intelligent system of which you are a superb agent. Thank you so much, Dean Radin.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks very much to Andrew Chadwick in D.C. and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, and we will reconvene again next week. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.